This is Radio EcoShock.
Most of us have a gut worry about the state of governments, big banks, and big finance, like maybe we'll wake up one morning with nothing. Our guest, Chris Martinson, trained as a scientist but retrained in business. He made good money in the investment world with a big American corporation. Then the Martinson family changed life dramatically. We'll ask him why and then pick his brain about things we all wish we knew. Chris Martinson, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's my pleasure.
Chris, in a talk at Oxford University in 2010, the very wealthy investor Jim Rogers told students to forget about financial careers and go study agriculture or mining. In a way, you made a similar transition. Tell us about your journey from the business world to a more rural life.
You know, this like all good journeys, I was a little bit self-interested to start. I was very concerned with what was happening around 2000, 2001, as the economy shredded itself and my portfolio did poorly. And everything I'd saved for, worked hard, lived the American dream, played by the rules, and still I was losing. And so I looked into the economy and almost immediately shocked myself with what I found, things that were not commonly talked about, not in my circle, not in the newspapers, things about debt, deficits, overall levels of economic sort of weakness that really spoke to me in a way that said, this could end badly. And I started digging deeper and went into the data and suddenly saw that the future that I was counting on almost certainly wasn't going to be there when I got there. The future that I was counting on was the one we all counted on. It's going to be slightly larger. It's going to be a little bit more of the same. There's more opportunities. The economy is going to grow. And once I saw the data that's now collected in the crash course and book and on my website, once I got this data in one spot, I said, I'm looking at a very distinct possibility that there could be disruptions, severe dislocations in our economy and by extension in our food systems and by extension in our energy systems. That is, I saw a world of complex interconnection that was at once very cost effective and also, if viewed a certain way, potentially very brittle. And that concerned me. So my wife, my children, and I, we made the transition away from a fairly unsustainable lifestyle to one that's more resilient. And on the surface, it looks like we moved out into the country a little bit. But what we're really doing is creating both deeper points of resilience in our own personal lives, as well as more community engagement.
And there is so much stress out there about banking and broke governments as the trillions accumulate. And I'm hearing a growing group of bloggers and radio hosts and other people who just wish it would all end somehow. And some are even cheering for a collapse. Where are you on that spectrum?
Oh, careful what you wish for. I'm not in the camp that's wishing for any of this to happen. I'm a realistic optimist. I do believe that the trends and forces that are in play will have to come to some sort of a resolution. In that resolution, I can't see any possible conclusion other than one where there's generally a lower standard of living, because just economically, we've been living well beyond our means in terms of our expenditures, debt levels, all of that. But we've been living well beyond our means from our natural capital as well, specifically around energy, but also around soil, water, other things like that. We're going to have to make an adjustment. So my hope is that we get to make these adjustments gradually and on our own terms. My worry is that we will deny this reality as long as possible. I mean, we at the official levels will attempt to maintain and preserve the status quo. We'll do everything possible to just sort of keep things moving along, and we'll face a much more, shall I say, sudden adjustment period. That one worries me quite a bit.
And there are several factors playing around here, and one of them, of course, is perhaps peak oil, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you a pressure point that I see and that a lot of our listeners believe in because of climate science is the pressure from climate change. Where do you stand on that?
Well, that's something that's almost entirely impossible to predict what the immediate impacts of that are going to be. And my stance on this is that we are going to run into and encounter very severe, very immediate, very proximate difficulties that will impact people very directly in the economy first, probably in the energy sector second, probably in the environment around climate change third. The climate change, besides being unpredictable, is a much longer sweeping sort of a trend. I have much more immediate concerns that I'm looking at this point.
Well, I'd agree with you, except for the summer in April that we're all experiencing. But you could be right, and I think I generally agree with you. You know, a scientist named Tim Garrett wrote a 2009 paper saying that there is a historic relationship between energy and wealth. More energy makes more wealth, less energy makes less. What are your thoughts about those relationships between energy availability and wealth?
If you have energy, you can build and form all sorts of other types of wealth. And whether you have a capitalist system or a Marxist system, and whether you've got good laws or bad laws, or you protect intellectual property rights and all those other niceties that sort of distinguish why we might live in one country or another, all become useless and irrelevant if you don't have energy to start with. So I think we can appreciate this if we were farming and it's just us, and as long as our farming efforts are returning more calories, that is energy, than we're expending, then we have the ability to form wealth, to store food, to take that food and do other things with it. Those are our profits. Without that food as that energy source, though, nothing else on this hypothetical farm is possible. It all begins with energy. And we tend to lump it in societally. It's a commodity. Look, you want to talk commodities, we can talk about silver and grains and cotton and molybdenum and oil, and we just sort of mix it in there, but it's not equivalent. None of those other commodities are even possible without oil. So oil is, or energy is, that is the foundational beginning of all other activities. So I look at this, very, very carefully, because there's a story here, which isn't just the amount of oil that's available, which is really what people mostly talk about in the peak oil story. Will we have more or less? What really matters is the quality of that energy. How much energy are we getting back for the energy we're expending? That story is really undertold at this point, and I believe is the key to understanding why everything is sort of unfolding the way it is today.
Yeah, well, we really see that in Canada, where the tar sands is just so much natural gas is being burned to boil it out, and so much energy being expended. You get about 3 barrels of oil for every barrel of energy you put into it. Well, look, on your blog at chrismartinson.com, you ran a 2-part series by Gregor MacDonald called The Race for BTUs. I thought it was excellent. What do you make of the claims that North America will become an oil giant once again?
I'll laugh at that. Because, look, when we're drilling in the Bakken fields right now, the shale oil plays are one of the headline stories that have been run in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Forbes. You just can't open a magazine without reading about this wonderful tight oil plays that we're getting. And here's what we need to understand about that story. Every single well that we drill in the Bakken play right now is returning about 150 barrels per day of production. Well, let's compare that to the United States consuming about 18 million barrels per day. And I think you can see there's a pretty enormous gap. You'd have to drill a lot of wells. And it turns out when you calculate the total acreage that's available, and it's immense, 20,000 square miles of land can be drilled in North Dakota, it still doesn't even remotely get you close to filling the gap for how much the United States consumes. That's part one. Canada consumes on a per capita basis even slightly more than the U.S. The general trend in energy use has been more and more and more, year after year after year. There are two big forces at work here. One, we want to be burning more because that's how economies grow. And remember, an economy is just things moving from point A to point B and people consuming it. And all of that starts with energy. So if you want more economy and it means you want more things, you have to have more energy. That story is being clipped at, though, by the idea that the existing fields, that many of which were drilled in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, are depleting and are running out. So today, in order for North America to just be producing slightly more energy or oil, we have to be making up for shortfalls in existing fields, cover that gap, then we can start talking about new additions to the overall mix. I've analyzed the numbers. There's really no possible way that the United States is going to get to be anything but an oil importer for the conceivable future. My guess is forever.
And what about the lack of refineries? That's another thing covered in that story. 3 refineries on the U.S. East Coast have closed because the oil they were built for is too expensive or going elsewhere. We're down to the heavy oil, and we don't have the pipelines to connect up to the refineries we do have. What have you heard about this, and how might that affect the ordinary person?
Well, this is going to affect us extraordinarily. If we'd, instead of taking $1 trillion and giving it to the bankers, had taken that same trillion and put it into our infrastructure. So what's being pointed out here is that, oil refineries, it's much more complicated than most people are aware. they're built for and tuned for a specific grade of oil. Oil comes in all different grades, from stuff that you literally have to move around with a spatula, it's so thick, to really light, sweet stuff that's practically gasoline straight out of the ground, and everything in between. Tar sands being a really, or oil sands, what they're being called now, being an extraordinarily dense, viscous, goopy stuff, right? Each one of these different grades of oil requires a different manufacturing process or refining process in order to crack it and turn it into the wonderful things that we use on a daily basis. And many of these refineries were built for, obviously, the better grades of oil. And now we're down to the nasty stuff. It's really heavy and sour, meaning it's got impurities in it, sulfur, vanadium, nitrogen, stuff that we don't want, and you have to get rid of in the refining process. Well, refining is a low-margin business, and when it turns out that you are being squeezed by higher input costs on one end, a lower quality of feedstock on the other end, it really just destroys profits and profitability. So most of these refineries that are shutting down because they would require an extraordinary capital infusion to bring them up to grade to process a different grade of crude, and it just doesn't make economic sense.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with alternative finance guru Chris Martinson. Many people expect a destabilizing blow to come from high gas prices at the pump, but I think it may come in the grocery store. There's potential damage to this year's crops from lack of snow cover in the prairies. A big part of the South and East are experiencing drought conditions, and there's a host of other problems. Chris, do you expect a food crisis in the coming times?
You know, it was, when was it? It was December 2006, everything was fine. January 2007, everything's fine. February 2007, there's a world food crisis. And it happened just like that. And it wasn't because we suddenly ran out of rice. It was that the perception of scarcity suddenly developed, and we saw countries hoard food because as every country knows that it's really important that you don't run out of food. And so for a long time, we've been watching world grain stocks be in almost perfect balance with demand, so supply and demand, very well balanced. And then something started to happen, and particularly it's accelerated, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years. There have been these extraordinary weather anomalies, whether it was the searing droughts that basically cooked the Russian grain basket, destroying a wheat crop there. It was the extraordinary floods down in the Queensland area of Australia, again, destroying a bunch of croplands, primarily wheat. And so we've been seeing these weather anomalies. Certainly weather has always been a complicating factor in farming, and that's always been true. But right now what we're trying to do is add about 80 million people a year to the planet through population growth, and we have farmland that's pretty much everything that can be farmed is being farmed at this point in time. We've been using fairly destructive farming practices worldwide, meaning we're strip mining the soil for nutrients. And against all of this, we now have what appear to be slightly larger than normal weather anomalies for the past few years. It creates a lot of strains on the food system. So all of these strains are here and present right now. I'm not of the view that by 2050, you know, we're going to have a food problem. I think we are literally one bad harvest away from having an extraordinarily dramatic spike in food prices beyond what we've already been experiencing. Anybody who shops knows that food inflation is running a lot higher than the government admits to. And I'm of the view that anything that individuals and communities can do to increase their food resilience right here, right now, whether it's planting a single tree in the yard that bears fruit, that these are going to be extraordinarily good investments to make from a resilience standpoint, quality of life standpoint, nutritional standpoint, whichever angle you come at it from. This is going to be a good time to sort of dust off that victory garden concept and think about that in terms of maybe our own self-interest or community interest or altruism for our neighbors, however you want to spin that. It just makes sense today, I think.
I couldn't agree more. I'm wondering, on another tack, how much pressure is the average North American feeling because of increased consumer demand in Asia? In a resource-constrained world, do we have to give up everything others gain?
Well, if you're going to adhere to this concept of free trade, meaning that, you know, grain prices are set on the world market stage and U.S. farmers are free to sell their wares anywhere they want, which is the current system, there's an extraordinary amount of strain, if you will, coming from increased demand from Asia. Soybean prices in particular, any of the base grains at this point are really experiencing extraordinary demand. China's out locking up really very long-term, very, very large contracts. Because the hidden thing in the grain story right now is that for most countries, When they import grain, what they're really doing is they're importing water. Water is the underlying difficult element in almost every single country's hopes for increased grain production. China's decimated its aquifer water tables. We're doing that here, too, but it hasn't quite pinched us yet. Of course, the Middle East is just a complete disaster because their water tables were very deep and salty and not that great to begin with because it's a desert. And so what we're really seeing is we've got a global insufficiency of water in many cases, or it's just distributed oddly compared to where the farmland is. And so China's out there importing water, as far as I'm concerned. And I do believe that we are going to be hearing more and more about rising food prices driven by this idea of both demand and possibly even scarcity.
So in response to some of these problems, I've seen promos for your program called Crash Course. Can you tell us about that and what is in it?
Sure. The Crash Course is my best effort. It took me years to develop, and I condensed a lot of material down. And there's three big E's that I want people to know about, and I think we have to look at all three together. We can't look at them individually anymore. The economy being one, energy being another, the environment being a third. And then under tying all three of those E's together is a fourth E, and it's called exponential growth. And it's the kind of growth that we're experiencing in population, in money supply, debt levels, number of Krispy Kreme donuts sold. I mean, we're just surrounded by these exponential functions, meaning that everything's going just a little bit faster and faster and faster. And understanding that kind of growth in the context of these three E's is essential, a central context that I think gives pretty good explanatory power for how we got here and maybe a glimpse at where we're going to end up.
Would you care to offer us a credible scenario where the current macro financial system melts down relatively quickly? What would be the warning signs, if any, and what would we as ordinary people, you know, the kind who have to go to work for our next paycheck, what would we experience?
Well, I'm holding my fingers really close together. We came this close in 2008. And I had warned people at my site and some of my subscribers, I'd warned that we were very close to a banking system meltdown. I was looking at things in the financial world. I spent a lot of time looking in the financial world because one of the things it is, it's a great communication device. There are millions of self-interested eyeballs out there looking at stuff. And so in 2008, nobody came out and no government official, no banking official came out and said, wow, we're in deep crisis here. What was happening was financial shares, stocks were getting killed. The credit spreads on their underlying debt were blowing out, meaning that investors in their debt were dumping them like crazy. And just a couple of warning signs like that told me that we were in really deep problems. And, of course, nobody admitted to that. 2 years later, 2010, Mervyn King, Bank of England governor, comes out and says, hey, we just want you to know we were about 4 hours away from a complete systemic banking crisis back in 2008. And what that would have meant to the average person is a banking crisis works like this. A big bank, maybe it was Lehman Brothers in 2008, but it could be somebody new today, a Spanish bank, a French bank, a U.S. bank, doesn't matter. But one really big giant, one of the top 20 banks, gets into trouble, and none of the other banks will deal with it because they don't know if this institution is good for it. So they won't honor letters of credit, credit swaps, any sort of bank transfers, nothing. This bank sort of becomes a pariah. And all of a sudden, because that one bank is a pariah, they can't honor their agreements, and then another bank becomes a pariah, and the whole thing happens in a domino effect, and next thing you know, nobody will do business with anybody at the banking level. Well, as soon as that happens, everything changes very, very rapidly. That would result in what we would call a bank holiday. Officials would come out and say, well, there's some situations we have to clear up. Banks aren't going to open globally for, or at least in the Western nations this week. We're hoping we'll have them open again next week. And they'll be quickly trying to figure out what goes on behind the scenes. But what does that mean? Well, for gasoline to go from the distributor out to the retail levels, for the trucks to roll across the highways, for ships to go in the ocean, requires a functioning credit system. And that requires a functioning banking system. So if our banking system shuts down, I would imagine that there will be some fairly dramatic cascading effects into our just-in-time global delivery system for everything from food to fuel to medical supplies and prescriptions, you name it. Everything sort of moves by this very large, as I mentioned, it's a very cost-effective system. If the trucks roll into your community every night, you will have food the next day. But if that system, for whatever reason, slows down, we will suddenly see very, very large, dramatic impacts, which we saw a sort of a microcosm of that with the tsunami in Japan. It shut down a couple of key factories because of the damage that happened. And one example, there was this lithium polymer ion. This is what they do. And they make this funny substance that's used in batteries that are shaped in certain devices. But this was the only plant that made it. And because of that, they didn't have enough of this polymer, which, you know, allows them to make these batteries. And the next thing you knew, all kinds, it was a huge hiccup in the worldwide delivery of electronic devices. So that is an example of a cascading effect. But what I'm talking about, if the banking holiday happens, it's not a single factory that shuts down. It's potentially an entire region. It's potentially whole industries. It could be very, very serious. This is why I'm convinced the authorities, will do everything possible to prevent that. But if they can't, I think people should be prepared. And a few of the simple things that I recommend people do is have some actual physical cash out of the bank, just in case, like we saw with Katrina in 2005, when the ATMs didn't work down there anymore. Cash really helped. This would be a similar example. And to whatever extent possible, if you have goods, be it food or clothing or whatever, that you can reasonably buy and in advance, meaning you will be using these things up anyway in the normal course of things, this is the deep pantry concept. But I might extend that to sort of a deep closet, a deep basement. Just sort of think about what happens if you can't every day jump in your car and get exactly what you need in that minute. What would you do? You know, what sorts of things are relevant in your life? It's not a huge extensive list, but just building a little buffer, a little inventory in our own lives, I think just makes sense today.
Listeners, you just got some good advice from Chris Martinson, the investment expert who's not afraid to look a bear in the face. And you can find out a lot more on his website, chrismartinson.com. Chris, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight.
Alex, it's been my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.